Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's show, we are continuing our ongoing discussions about California's wildfires. At least 8 fires are raging in the state as triple-digit temperatures across the state break records. Yesterday, we talked about preventative measures and what was learned from last year's devastating fires. Today, we're talking about how people are coping and who should be held responsible. Last November, the Camp Fire in Paradise, California, killed more than 85 people and destroyed more than 14,000 homes. That's according to California's Department of Finance. Survivors are still recovering and struggling to meet their needs. But reconstruction is beginning, and the mayor of Paradise, a town that was all but wiped out by the fire, is promising the community will come back stronger and more resilient. Residents, legislators, and administrators are looking for ways to better manage land and harden homes against fires to mitigate the risks of living in burn-prone areas. Meanwhile, PG&E, the utility whose equipment fire investigators found to have sparked the campfire, is facing $30 billion in wildfire claims, and it's in talks with legislators to create an $11 billion recovery fund to cover claims related to damages. Joining us to talk about how families and residents in Paradise are coping is Eric Lofdolm, a Rocklin County, Northern California resident who, along with his wife, started Paradise Adopt a Family, a community group formed to connect fire survivors with people willing and able to help them meet their immediate needs. Hi, Eric. Welcome to the show.
I'm excited to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
Well, thank you for joining us. So why don't you just give us a quick update about how people are doing in Paradise? What are the greatest needs since the campfire in November?
Yeah, you know, it's really across the board. 50,000 plus people became displaced or homeless overnight, and some of them are doing great. Some of them have relocated or found, you know, adequate housing. In some cases, they've gotten jobs, they've got, you know, vehicles and so forth, and other people are really struggling, and they're not doing well at all. They are in need of money for food or gas or a running vehicle. You know, just living in general is tough enough, and when you lose everything overnight, it just is devastating for so many of these folks.
And on the Facebook group that you started, Paradise Adopt a Family, people are still posting looking for help with everything, like you said, from housing to food to gas money.
Yeah, and this will likely go on for at least 12 more months. You know, it's hard for any of us that weren't affected by the fire to even imagine what it would be like if all of a sudden you were homeless and you lost all your vehicles and maybe your job was gone. It's like, what do you do at that point? And so I think a lot of people are thinking, why haven't these people recovered yet? Well, if you put yourself in their shoes, it's easy to understand why they haven't recovered.
Right. Can you talk about the number of families that have sought help through Paradise Adopt a Family?
Well, at our height, we had, I think, 34,000 members. That's a combination of people that want to help and people that were affected. So I'm gonna guess somewhere between 3,000 and 4,000 individual fire survivors are a part of that group. And, you know, many of them, thousands have asked for help, and there's been incredible miracles that have taken place as a result of that Facebook group.
Well, 34,000. That's just a huge number.
Yeah, when my wife and I started the group, the reason I chose to just do a Facebook group is in my business, Facebook groups are part of how I communicate with my clients. And rarely do I get a group that grows above 1,000 people. So when the group was formed, I thought maybe 1,000 would join, maybe we would help out like 10 families, and that would be that. And we were growing at 1,000 people a day for a while, and I was using my business skills to organize and motivate people to help, and it was incredible. I think that we were producing like 50,000 a day in real value of donations, trailers being donated, vehicles. I mean, it was literally just miracles that were happening.
Mm. And were you getting donations from all parts of the country?
Yeah, we had them coming from all over. And in a lot of cases, most cases, the helpers, that's what we call them, you're either a helper or you're a survivor. And the helpers were, they would just find the survivors on their own. And my wife and I and our admin team, we weren't involved at all in that. We just were like kind of like the Match.com of the fire, right? And but in some cases, people would come to us and they'd say, hey, can you do the match for us? Or we're going to give you, you know, find somebody that needs a trailer. And so we would get actively involved and make the match happen.
And if for people listening, if they want to become a helper, what's the best way to go about it at this point?
So the Facebook group is still open. And if you go to Facebook, it's Paradise Fire Adopt a Family. Or our website is ParadiseFireAdoptAFamily.com. If you go into the Facebook group, you can see people posting, you know, on a regular basis asking for support. And you can just go directly to somebody that needs help and reach out to them and say, hey, I would like to see how I can help you. And just, I would advise you get on the phone with them. And you help in any way that you choose to.
All right. Well, and if any of you, any listeners, would like to know the best way to get involved or to help, there's still so much need after that horrific fire in Paradise, California last November. Eric will be with us for about five more minutes, and you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Eric, do you know how long did it take for FEMA to help people in the area?
You know, that's a great question, and I really don't know anything about FEMA or the government and how they operate. One interesting thing, though, is that FEMA opened up a in the Sears building in Chico. They opened up shop there, and we had a booth in the FEMA building. We were the only non-organization, because we're a Facebook group. We're not actually an organization. And they recognized us, and they gave us a booth in there. And so we were boots on the ground inside of the Sears building for, you know, as long as that was open. So, but I don't know specifically when their timeline was.
And what are you hearing from families? Because Sherry McCracken, the chief administrative officer of Butte County, and that includes Paradise, testified at a commission hearing that the campfire had left a magnitude of destruction that people just cannot quite grasp. And she recently told the New York Times that the county was still providing shelter for about 50 households displaced by the fire, in addition to an unknown number of people living in their cars, churches, or tents. So do you know, are people still living in cars, churches, or tents?
Yeah. I mean, just the other day, we helped a woman who was living in her car, and she relocated to Oregon, and she got a job, but she needed a place to live. And we had a gentleman in Modesto who had lost his home in a fire years prior, and he reached out to me and said, hey, I have a trailer to donate. So we made that match. We got the trailer hauled all the way to Oregon, and she found a place to put the trailer. So she had been living in her car even though she got a job. And a lot of these folks, they don't have the skill sets to know, like, how to like project manage everything that's going on. They're still dealing with PTSD. They're just overwhelmed. And so I think that's one of the ways that we've been able to help so much. When I say we, the helpers in the group, the thousands of helpers, to just come in and kind of problem solve for these people and help them put their lives back together.
Wow. What about the people who owned businesses? Those are all gone. People who have no work to go to. How are they coping?
Yeah, and that's the problem. You know, maybe you have somebody that's been in a job for 30 years and they just had their regular routine, and now all of a sudden they need the skill sets to, you know, relocate, find a new job, raise capital. You know, it's overwhelming, and a lot of these people don't know what to do. In many cases, they don't have access to their doctors. Mm. Some of these folks are seniors. I mean, it's just a giant, giant mess, and, you know, we're helping as many people as we can.
Wow. Eric, before we let you go, just given what you've done here, all the stories that you've heard, what message would you send to state officials about, you know, ensuring that people have the basic help that they need? Because it's really hot right now, and at least 8 wildfires are currently raging in California.
It's a great question, and it's not really for me to answer, because I don't really know anything about any of that. All I know is we started a Facebook group and we're helping as many as we can, but I wouldn't feel qualified to, you know, make recommendations to the state, because it's just not what I know.
What about community groups for the future, groups that want to help if something horrific like this happens in the future?
Well, my wife and I created a model that it largely is, it's likely the most impactful Facebook group that may have ever been created in the history of disaster relief. And there is a model there, and if, you know, anybody listening right now that has an interest in recreating this model, there's going to be, you know, I think you said there's 8 wildfires happening right now. Mm-hmm. California's, it's just part of California. And so if anyone is interested in learning how to do what we did, you know, we intuitively created a model that worked.
Well, thank you for all the work that you did there, you and your wife, and thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Eric Lofdalm is a Rockland County resident up in Northern California. He and his wife started Paradise Adopt a Family. This is a community Facebook group formed to connect fire survivors in Paradise with people willing and able to help them meet their immediate needs. And as Eric said, there is still so much need. And so if you want to get involved and help, that Facebook page is Paradise Adopt a Family. This is Your Call, and we're continuing our coverage of devastating wildfires in California. Yesterday, we talked about preventative measures and what officials learned from last year's fires. Today, we are talking about how people are coping and who should be held responsible. And now I would like to welcome Mike Wara to the show. Mike is senior research scholar at the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment and director of the Climate and Energy Policy Program. He's a lawyer and scholar focused on climate and energy policy. He also serves on California's Commission on Catastrophic Wildfire Cost and Recovery. Hi, Mike. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on again.
Nice to have you. Jamie Court is president of Consumer Watchdog, a nonprofit dedicated to providing an effective voice for citizens in an era when special interests dominate public discourse, government, and politics, and they are harsh critics of PG&E. Hi, Jamie. Welcome back to the show.
Glad to be back. Thanks.
Great to have both of you. I want to start off by talking about just what the state can do better to help people. I mean, we just heard from Eric that in Paradise, people are still living in their cars, churches, and tents. And Mike, you're on a commission, the Commission on Catastrophic Wildfire Cost. And you say that the state just hasn't come to grips with the kind of investment that's required. I mean, what is the state doing now to help people who have lost everything, and what needs to improve?
Well, I think the issues in Paradise and also in Napa and Sonoma counties and in Southern California, where, you know, the Thomas and Woolsey fires were really devastating, have how to manage rebuilding of entire communities is a huge challenge, particularly in contexts where we're not building enough housing to start with, and where, you know, the logistics of moving permits through the planning process in local governments tends to get jammed up. But I think the issues that we focused on the commission really involve, you know, the broader question of what we can do to protect all of the other communities that are like Paradise but have not yet experienced a catastrophic wildfire. And I think there's enormous amount of work we have in the state to make communities safer and to help people who couldn't otherwise afford to do the kinds of things that need to be done to afford the changes that we all can make to have a safer California.
Jamie, what are your thoughts?
Well, the state's got to stop taking money from PG&E. I mean, we've got every major legislator in Sacramento is taking a bundle from PG&E, you know, like $11 million, and they are not doing what they need to do to hold PG&E accountable. I mean, the reason the campfire started, we need to remember, is that there was a 100-year-old tower that was supposed to be replaced at 75 years, and PG&E didn't do it. And this is after PG&E was a 6-time convicted felon. And it's cut off payments to Butte fire victims in bankruptcy. It ran to bankruptcy, so it didn't have to pay full fair value to fire victims. I mean, what the state needs to do is tell PG&E, look, we don't need you. We can take over your assets. We can look towards a publicly owned utility or break PG&E's assets up so the municipal utilities can take it over. There is an alternative, and I don't think that has resonated in Sacramento because of the type of political influence we have seen PG&E, you know, in the past engage in, and even currently. PG&E funds all sorts of policy discussions. PG&E and the utilities, you know, had a funded a shindig in Maui when the Camp Fire was raging and the Woolsey Fire was raging. It's called the Independent Voter Project, and they talked about a bailout for the utilities. So we cannot just keep bailing these companies out if they don't engage in mitigation efforts. And the biggest thing we need to do is make sure that they clear the vegetation that started the fires around these lines, which they have been resisting for a decade before last year. And at the same time, they modernize their equipment, and the state's giving them plenty of funding to do that. But we can't let these companies be too corrupt to fail, and that's where we are with PG&E. And I think the commission that Michael sits on just came up with such utility-friendly recommendations, and it's got a majority of people who are very connected to the utilities, and that is a big problem for the state if the legislature adopts those recommendations.
Well, Mike, I'll ask you to respond to that, but before you do, for people who are not familiar with this Commission on Catastrophic Wildfire Cost and Recovery, can you just tell us how this came about, who's on it, and what are the goals, and then you can tell us about your findings.
Absolutely. So the commission was created by legislation enacted last year in the aftermath of the Napa-Sonoma fire siege and the Thomas fire. And the idea of the commission was to provide a space for some long-term thinking about how to stabilize the situation for investor-owned utilities in the state of California. And I completely agree with a lot of what Jamie just said about errors in management that have occurred in the past and may still be occurring. I can't speak to that. But the reality is that electricity is an essential service in the state. We all need it. We're increasingly dependent on it as we move toward cleaner energy in the state. We need to make sure that the electricity that we consume is affordable for everyone. And that situation is under pressure in the state of California, especially for people who live away from the coasts where it's hotter and air conditioning is a must. And the wildfires pose really an existential challenge because the investors, which are not regulated by California, which we cannot control, have concluded that California utilities are very high risk investments, and therefore investments made by the utilities are becoming much more expensive. You know, it's sort of like moving from a 30-year mortgage to financing everything on a high interest credit card. And that really is a huge challenge for affordability of electricity in California. So our goals have been to protect ratepayers, and then, recognizing the points that Jamie just made, to figure out a system where we can be sure that victims of fires, if and when they do occur, will get paid and get paid quickly. And those are kind of the two big priorities. Now, I'll be honest, having healthy utilities in some cases is going to be consistent with those two priorities, right? We need to, in order to protect ratepayers, you need to make sure that the utilities can borrow at low cost. That is an incredible, you know, if we're going to make wildfire safety investments, we need to make sure that utilities can borrow at low cost. And so that means that healthy utilities are a part of stabilizing bills for ratepayers. But I couldn't agree more that the utilities need to have their feet held to the fire. In particular, management of the utilities needs to have its feet held to the fire. And I actually would not just single out PG&E in this respect. I think Southern California Edison has a lot of work to do. San Diego made investments after 2007 fires that were devastating in the county. And the utility basically said, never again. And they did some forward-thinking work, and they've dramatically improved safety in their service territory. Edison and PG&E have not done that, and we've seen the results, and they are terrible over the last couple of years. So I could not agree more that the utilities and the utility shareholders need to be held to account, but we cannot cut off our nose to spite our face. The reality is we don't have good alternatives to grid-supplied electricity, and I would argue that moving toward publicly owned utilities, while it is a potentially viable strategy, has a lot of potential downsides as well. In particular, the need to purchase the system, right? We can't just seize private assets, we would need to buy them, and that would require expenditure of significant sums of money. The next thing to think about on the publicly owned side is the safety record of the entities that manage energy resources in the state of California, and I would point to the Oroville spillway collapse and the subsequent work that was done after that to look at safety culture within DWR. It's not clear to me that there's better safety culture within our state-operated public energy infrastructure than there is in the private infrastructure. Doesn't mean we shouldn't move in a municipal direction. It just means that we need to do so thoughtfully and carefully if that's the direction we choose, and we need to recognize the downsides for ratepayers of moving in that direction.
When you say that PG&E's feet need to be held to the fire, what do you mean exactly?
Well, I think I mean two things. The first thing is that getting out of the hole we're in from a electricity perspective in this state requires shared sacrifice. The reality is ratepayers are going to be asked to contribute, but they should not pay for the whole fixing the whole problem. And I think that the shareholders of PG&E need to pay at least as much as ratepayers do, and of the other utilities as appropriate, to contributing to a solution that's workable for everyone, that stabilizes rates for ratepayers, and stabilizes the risk situation so that the utilities return to being able to invest in safety and other improvements at low cost. The second thing I mean is that I think that management in the utility space in California has been too short-term, and I imagine that Jamie would agree with me with respect to that, too focused on this year's profits, not enough focused on what happens in the long term. And I think that in exchange for help, the state should ask for a series of reforms to how management at the major investor-owned utilities is compensated that focuses them on long-term performance and safety.
Well, Jamie, Mike brought up a number of things there.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we just give some context here? As you said, PG&E has a 100-year-old tower. Can you tell us what PG&E was supposed to do? Was it 25 years ago?
It was supposed to replace it at 75 years. That was the protocol. Their internal memos from the company, the New York Times got their hands on, that showed that they knew that they had to replace it, and they didn't. And this was the source of the fire. And this culture goes back. Let's back up why it's a six-time felon before that to San Bruno, where it didn't replace pipes it should have. Instead, it diverted that money for corporate and executive salaries, and the pipes blew up, and eight people died, and San Bruno was wrecked. We go back all the way to the Aaron Brockovich movie, the chemical spills. I mean, this is a company that can't be reformed, and the current management's not going to do any better. So to have a recommendation that says shared sacrifice, when I hear shared sacrifice, what that basically means is wildfire victims, give up your right to sue these companies, which is what this recommendation of this commission was, that they get rid of the inverse condemnation doctrine, which is actually in the California Constitution. If a utility puts equipment in your backyard, they're responsible when it burns, and get rid of the maxim that when campfires caused because of corporate negligence, and this is a PUC rule, that shareholders pay, not ratepayers, not wildfire victims. I don't think until wildfire victims are guaranteed everything they have in their losses, including what's owed to the Butte fire victims, there should be one reform moving anywhere in Sacramento to bail anyone out. Until we have a deal to get wildfire victims pay right from the shareholders, no one should get anything. And there aren't verdicts, by the way, in the 2017 or the 2018 fires. There aren't settlements there. PG&E fled to bankruptcy so it didn't have to pay what it should pay in these courts and try to create a political solution, and it last year we bailed them out for the 17 fires. Now they're coming back under the cover of this commission. Let me tell you, this is a five-member commission. Michael Kahn, who's on the commission, was the chair of ISO under Gray Davis. I mean, you know, this is in the original energy crisis. This is an insider who is very connected to the big financial and energy markets. We have Carla Peterman, who was on the PUC, and in her voting record in the PUC, she voted for fossil fuel projects. She led the attack on community choice aggregation. She's got not a great record. Mr. Wara, it seems like a very nice gentleman, but he is on the advisory committee of the Natural Gas Group at Stanford, which is funded by Sempra, SoCalGas, PG&E, according to the website. And then, these are people who are not they're saying shared sacrifice because their orientation is towards the utilities, not towards the public, and they were put there, frankly, to come up with recommendations that creates the possibility of another bailout in Sacramento, which when the governor came up with his principles, he said, you know, everyone needs to share in this. And ratepayers need to share. Insurance companies, are going to have to share, and wildfire victims are going to have to, share in some way. And inverse condemnation, losing their right to sue, is a big one. So, I think all that is coming before we say, okay, all the people whose houses burned down because PG&E didn't do what it should have done. This convicted felon has thrown safety to the winds. Make sure they're paid before you even talk about any of this. But instead of that, we're using the fact that these folks are in the lurch as a way to bail out these utilities. And I go back with the utilities to the turn of the century when we did the same thing. PG&E is the only utility to go into bankruptcy twice. I don't think there's a handful of utilities that have gone into bankruptcy once. This company is not worth saving. And the public knows it. Recent PPIC polls just last week showed they're very worried about having to pay the cost for these fires. Because Sacramento shares the blame. The approval rating of the legislature is 30%. So you can create a commission. You can do a song and dance. You can do a dog and pony show. You can come up with recommendations that sound like they're by independent experts on paper. They're not. They're the same people who've been telling us we've got to protect Wall Street confidence in the utilities forever, rather than worrying about protecting the safety of the public and the cost of our electricity, which is higher than everywhere else. Municipalization, if you look at municipal utilities like SMUD in Sacramento, DWP in L.A., I mean, they are not with the same type of fire. They don't really have any fire liabilities, and DWP in L.A. does have some pretty rural turf. Now, PG&E does cover a lot more fire-prone territories, but obviously, when they're responsible for the campfire because of their negligence, and we see these other safety issues, they've exacerbated their own losses. What we get by going the route of turning it back to the public is being able to invest in burying the lines, invest in doing all the right things, and having political accountability when things go wrong. Not a company that then just goes into bankruptcy twice and tries to pull the same thing that it did last time, as if no one remembers. Well, the public remembers. This last poll should tell every legislator who's going to vote on the plan that the governor's going to probably want to support and that this commission's going to put forth, and the guy who did the legislation for the commission, Dodd, is probably going to write. When they vote for this, they should know that that 32% rating is because they are not listening to the public that has no confidence in PG&E and no confidence that ratepayers aren't being bilked for what shareholders should be paying. You know, we have privatized the risks we have privatized the gain from these companies time and again to the stock market, but we socialize the risk. And at some point, when it comes towards, you know, billions in liability, we've got to say no, and we've got to go in a different direction. Guys like Jerry Hill, there are a few of them in Sacramento. They understand that direction, but they are outcasts up there because they are not with the pack that is very, very prone to the utilities. Utilities spent more money lobbying on campaign contributions last year than any other lobby in Sacramento. That's why this proposal is moving forward. And that's why it shouldn't move forward. The public knows.
The reality is that the municipal utilities are just as exposed to inverse condemnation as the investor owns. In fact, probably more so. And they are the strongest advocates for elimination of strict liability under inverse condemnation, which is this kind of law that the constitutional doctrine that you're referring to. If we were to municipalize, we would have municipal utilities that are, or perhaps a state utility that is directly exposed to wildfire risk. What that would mean is that if there were a fire similar to the campfire or another fire of similar magnitude, the state coffers would be directly exposed. If that were to happen during a recession, we would be trading off schools, roads, and wildfire victims. I actually think it is a benefit that state resources are not directly exposed to this disaster. Now, I do not disagree with you that PG&E has a terrible record when it comes to safety culture, and they desperately need to change. And I think that there are significant reforms that are required. However, municipalization does not solve this problem. And the idea that simply municipalizing is going to magically solve the wildfire risk problem, I think lacks coherence. In addition, the status quo, doing nothing right now, is totally untenable. The reality is that Butte Fire victims who had settled their claims are getting nothing because of the bankruptcy. The reality is that Camp Fire victims and Napa Sonoma victims, when their claims are ultimately adjudicated, will get cents on the dollar because of a bankruptcy. If there is another fire in Southern California this year, it is very likely that Thomas and Woolsey victims will get cents on the dollar because Edison will be in bankruptcy. I think we're facing a crisis. And the reality, you know, you can say, oh, we just need to punish. And I think we do need to punish, but it can't be the whole answer, right? But because we need electricity, it's not clear that we want to expose the state to these massive and crushing liabilities. And I would just point to the Tubbs fire as an example of a situation that was not PG&E caused, right? That was a private utility line. It caused a massive fire. We do not want to expose public coffers to this risk until we have invested in mitigating it, in making people safer. And I think the safety issue is not just a PG&E question, right? Utilities all over the country do set fires. That's the reality. The problem in California is that fires are occurring that are simply uncontrollable once set. We need to reduce ignitions, but we also need to reduce fuels where people live so that the fires don't blow up and run 10 miles in a period of hours, burning downtown so quickly that people cannot even evacuate. And I think both of those things need to happen. Part of it is in the utility silo. Part of it is on the backs of communities, right? Making sure that homeowners have defensible space, building fuel breaks between wildlands where there is high fire risk and where people live, hardening homes. We have not invested enough in those risk mitigation measures. It would be as if we didn't have a brace and bolt program for earthquake risk, right? If we just said, well, you know, hopefully earthquakes won't happen. That's not that far from where we are in many places in California. And so we need to do both. Because, and I would just emphasize, and I think people need to think about what happened last year in Redding, right, at the Carr Fire. The Carr Fire was caused by a flat tire throwing sparks into dry grass. It generated an EF3 fire tornado that burned down 1,100 homes in a matter of hours. If the winds had not changed, that tornado would have burned into downtown Redding. I think we were incredibly lucky that day, but we cannot rely on luck to solve these problems. And climate change, unfortunately, is going to make this worse. And so we need to invest in strategies to keep people safe. Part of that is on the utility side, and we can have a legitimate debate about what the solutions are. But I think you cannot ignore the idea and the reality that we need to be doing things at the community level, at the homeowner level, to keep people safe. And we're underinvesting in those strategies right now. You know, the legislature last year, as part of 901, the big package that passed, doubled spending on defensible space fuel reduction, I should say, and prescribed fire in California. But they doubled it from $100 to $200 million. We need to be spending much more than that, given that we're facing tens of billions of dollars in losses each year.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. And after the break, Mike and Jamie, I would love for both of you to just really talk these issues out. I understand that you both have, in some ways, very different views about how we move forward, and in some other ways, similar views. But I would really appreciate it if you both would talk to each other, because we do have about 20 minutes left. So we can really kind of hash out these issues, because this is just so incredibly important. Mike Wara is Senior Research Director at the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. He serves on California's Commission on Catastrophic Wildfire Cost and Recovery. And Jamie Court is president of Consumer Watchdog. They're dedicated to providing a voice for citizens in an era when special interests dominate public discourse, government, and politics. And as you can hear, Jamie and Consumer Watchdog are very critical of PG&E. And if you'd like to join us, if you'd like to talk about what solutions you'd like to see, because unfortunately, we've got 8 wildfires raging right now in California as triple-digit temperatures across the state break records. And you know that we just saw so much devastation last year. You can email your call at kalw.org or give us a call, 866-798-8255. This is your call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about why so many horses are dying at U.S. racetracks. It's really alarming what's happening. The New York Times reporter Joe Drape was on the PBS NewsHour over the weekend, and he said based on a Freedom of Information Act request they filed in 2012, they found that 25 horses were dying every single week. And he looked at congressional testimony going back to the 80s. So we're hoping that we'll get him on the show tomorrow, and we'll talk about why these horses are dying and what is being done about it. Today, we are talking about the devastating wildfires in California. Yesterday, we talked about what officials have learned from last year's fires. Today, we're talking about who should be held responsible. We're joined by Mike Wara, senior research scholar at the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment. He serves on California's Commission on Catastrophic Wildfire Cost and Recovery. And Jamie Court, president of Consumer Watchdog. It's a nonprofit dedicated to providing a voice for citizens in an era when special interests dominate so many aspects of our lives. And I would love to have both of you. You know, I know that this is an issue that's, in many cases, there are layers to it. Luckily, we do have an hour, but I would ask both of you, rather than talk in very loud, long sound bites, like 5 minutes, if you can just really talk to each other about the ways that you think we should move forward. So, Mike, I wanted you to respond to Jamie's criticism of the commissioners and conflicts of interest.
Sure. Well, you know, what I can say is, Stanford, you know, I can't speak for the other commissioners because I don't know. You know, I know that I was vetted by Senate appointments. I'm an appointee of the Senate, and I was vetted by Senate appointments and asked for any conflict of interest that I might have with respect to the investor-owned utilities or frankly, anything having to do with the energy system in California. And, you know, I was happy to disclose, you know, any conflicts I had, and frankly, I don't have any. And because Stanford has taken small amounts of money in the context of the institution from Pacific Gas and Electric over the years, does not make me or the work that I do or the work of Stanford in any way hostage or captive to that electric utility. We certainly do work with the utilities in the state. You know, one of the things that Stanford is proud of and working hard on is how to innovate in the electricity space and to move toward a low carbon grid. And frankly, you know, the utilities in the state have been, to some degree, over time, partners in that work. And we should be proud of what they have accomplished in that space.
I also want to ask...
I got to say,
Jamie.
I cannot be proud of PG&E in any respect with regards to these fires. And that's the problem. And it's not with Michael. I really don't know Michael, and I'm sure he is. Everything he says is true. I really don't. It's not Michael. It's that we have had a utility establishment that's controlled our Public Utility Commission for a long time, going back to the former president, Mike Peavy, who's still under criminal investigation for his dealings with PG&E over the San Bruno mess and for his dealings with another utility in the state. I mean, the problem is this, that until you get people who aren't in business in any shape or form with the utilities, to be the Public Utility Commission, you will never have the public's voice heard there. It will always be about going to Wall Street and making sure the credit rating's good and making sure that, you know, the investors are happy. And that message has been for two decades why we've had problems with the utilities. What we need to do, I think, in stopping fires is Michael and I will totally agree with. Fire mitigation, investing money in safe communities, trying to power down lines when it's reasonable, so long as you don't put, you know, people who are in medically difficult situations at risk. All of that is stuff that everybody in the state agrees with, and we are moving forward on all those fronts as a state. There is no disagreement. The disagreement and the power struggle is about what PG&E, Sempra, and Edison have been trying to do for the last couple of years, which is remove themselves from liability they face today and to try to get the cost of the fires that happened in the past, even when they started them, onto the ratepayers and off the shareholders and the investors. That is not acceptable because of the way they've conducted themselves in the past, which includes spending a decade not wanting to do fire mitigation, not updating their maps, and the PUC didn't make them. So the, if we could agree on one simple thing to change all of this, and more importantly, if the governor, who now can appoint the president of the Public Utility Commission, agreed, we'd be in great shape. If we have a president of a public utility commission that's more interested in regulating utilities, that doesn't have the same view that has doomed the state for two decades, that is more interested in public safety, is willing to think out of the box, willing to think about municipalization, willing to do everything that the public would want and not just the utilities, we can get some creative solutions. But the problem is this debate is dominated by the Michael Kahns, who is on the commission, who has a long history going back to the last bankruptcy, by a lot of people on the inside who are whispering in the same people's ears from the same utilities, who've been in the same junkets, who've been in the same rooms with the lobbyists. It is incestuous. If you were to look at this problem from someone who came from outer space and just take it cold, we'd all agree. Make investments in stopping fires. Make investments adopting to this new normal, abnormal, whatever it is. But the two issues on the table that the public doesn't agree with and most normal advisors who don't have a relationship with the utilities would agree with is we shouldn't be bailing them out if the shareholders can pay for it, and we shouldn't be taking away a liability that's been established in the Constitution when it's not necessary.
Jamie, you brought up a couple things there. So when you're talking about passing costs on to citizens, has the CPUC approved PG&E's plan to increase monthly bills by about $12 in January 2020?
Well, the CPUC, as far as I know, has approved some plans to increase monthly bills, but they're also having to deal with what was passed last year in the legislature, which was a bailout over the 2017 fires that can be passed on. I don't know. I don't believe those have actually been passed on. There's a whole series of decisions they're going to make that are going to increase people's bills already. But what we're talking about now, what the commission's recommending, what the governor has put in a tentative report, and what the legislature's contemplating, is a whole nother bailout fund that says basically the utilities have the first couple of $1 billion of liability when they cause a fire. After that, it's a little more complicated than this, but to say it simply, after that, they buy insurance. The insurance companies cover a certain layer. After that, ratepayers cover a certain layer. After that, taxpayers cover a certain layer. After that, there is no more liability. They're trying to shift it all into a public bailout. I don't have any other word for it. You could call it a relief fund, but it's a bailout that takes it off the utilities and the shareholders and puts it on ratepayers in some form, taxpayers in some form. But then at the end of the day, if liability were to be greater than whatever they predict, and may or may not, there isn't any more liability.
And let me ask Mike, we're almost at the end of the show, and I want to be sure we get some callers in. And Mike, what are your thoughts on what Jamie said, that shareholders should pay, that PG&E should not be bailed out?
I totally agree that shareholders should pay. And I think, you know, if folks want to go and look at the draft report, the chapter on a wildfire fund, they'll see that, you know, in our view, and I think this far exceeds any proposal that the investor-owned utilities have put on the table so far. Let me just make that clear. In our view, for any dollar that ratepayers contribute, shareholders need to contribute at least a dollar to essentially a large insurance fund that would exist to help pay, make sure that wildfire victims get paid. And the problem right now is that the utilities can only purchase about $1 billion to $1.5 billion of insurance. There is no other insurance available at any price. And then at that point, they're self-insured. And the companies are not big enough to manage these liabilities. And so what we saw after the campfire, you know, is as long as there are wildfires still being set by utilities, something that is in some way inevitable. So we need to do two things. We need to make sure that the utilities can invest to build safer systems, and that may mean undergrounding, as Jamie suggested. I just point out, undergrounding costs millions of dollars per mile. Those millions of dollars have to come from somewhere. Generally speaking, they come from investors. If that's going to happen, we need to have investors that are willing to put their money into our companies.
Well, let me get some phone calls from our listeners, and then we'll get responses. Susan writes, I think executives at PG&E who made the decisions to increase their salaries rather than replace equipment should be held criminally liable. And let's go through a couple callers, and then we'll get responses. Let's hear from Luke in Berkeley. Hi, Luke.
Hi. Do you want me to just jump right in?
Yes, please.
Okay, so I've lost track of the different names of the guests because I've been sitting in traffic. But I was listening earlier to the one guest who was contending that PG&E and Edison should not be municipalized or otherwise made a public good, and I was screaming at the top of my lungs because it is precisely the profit motive that. And then another of your guests kind of pointed out the whole trail of tears of how this works and how the Public Utilities Commission has been co-opted. And the problem is that the people who are left holding the bill, which is for the most part ratepayers and taxpayers, do not have control over these utilities. And we are left, you know, holding the bag. And if we're going to be continually left holding the bag, especially as the grid is changing, and more people are adding solar and wind and other things, you know, in their homes and on their buildings and such, and it's changing the cooperative nature of the grid, it ought to be a public good. We ought to own it. I mean, if we're going to pay for it, we should own it.
Well, thank you, Luke, and sorry to cut you off. We'll definitely do a show about this, but I want to take a few more callers. Let's go to Alice in San Francisco. Hi, Alice.
Hello there. I wanted to second both the email that you received and the last caller. I think the CEO of PG&E received about $13.5 million in compensation. And why doesn't the money come from there? They have been faulty. They have been absolutely remiss in carrying out their responsibilities. I think it was reported after the San Bruno explosion in the San Francisco Chronicle that PG&E was offering incentives to inspectors who reported the fewest faults found in the network before the explosion. Now we know that they have not carried out their responsibilities even in maintenance, not to mention upgrading and improving the safety measures. Other municipalities do have publicly owned utilities, and in San Francisco, there are a lot of people who have been advocating for that. Why can't we have that?
Right, and also I remember a story in January. San Francisco Mayor London Breed is responding to the bankruptcy scandal by asking the San Francisco PUC to explore the feasibility of shutting out PG&E and providing power exclusively through city-owned assets. I was just reading from Curbed there. So thank you for that, Alice. Let's go to Mark in Berkeley. Hi, Mark.
Hi, thank you so much for the show. The situation is we're in a crisis right now, and we can't be distracted by PG&E's corruption. From San Bruno to the Enron crisis to now the fire, they've shown that their priorities are profit, and they just cannot be trusted to function, you know, in this crisis. And so if we don't start thinking about municipalization now, we will be here again soon, later in this year probably. It's inevitable. PG&E is just not up to the job. They're just too corrupt. I'll take a response on the air.
Thank you. Well, why don't I give both of you a minute to respond? Unfortunately, we're almost out of time. Let's hear first from Mike Wara, who's senior research scholar at the Stanford Woods Institute, and he also serves on California's Commission on Catastrophic Wildfire Cost and Recovery.
So a number of the callers have suggested that we should consider municipalization. I think that's something that should be on the table, and we should take a look at it. But we need to take a look at it taking account of the full costs and benefits of municipalization and with an honest eye on the capacity of a municipal state utility to provide greater safety.
And Jamie Court, president of Consumer Watchdog, what's your response to our callers?
Well, I think we should protect wildfire victims by regulating companies like PG&E and not pandering to them, and we shouldn't be afraid to prosecute and put corporate executives in jail so they don't continue to kill people with their negligence. And most of all, I think we shouldn't fear taking over companies like PG&E through eminent domain and use their assets for the public good without having to sacrifice safety and profits for shareholders. The thing that I would say to the governor is the most dangerous thing he can do right now is play it safe. This commission is all about playing it safe. Let's keep the same playbook we've been in for a long time. It got us here, and with PG&E, it's more than a three strikes and you're out thing. If we go the municipalization route, it's going to keep us safe in the long term. It's a big leap now from all those people who believe that Wall Street's the only way to deliver electricity, but that's been proven wrong. We should go for that leap because it's the safest thing we can do for everybody, and we'll have control over our destinies.
And just quickly, Jamie, what do you think about efforts that are happening in San Francisco?
I think it's great. We have a municipal utility, like a shell of one, that's been already created. So it actually could, it fits perfectly with the movement there. We have community choice aggregators. So we have, you know, a lot of these, the CAGs that the utilities have wanted to put out business. Now maybe if we could get them to be a little bit greener all across the board, they could have some life. I think there's a lot of interesting things moving. But, you know, the utilities, this is the big one. They say if we let them go, if we let PG&E become municipal, they're, you know, forget the green energy of the future. I think if we go municipal, we're going to have a better shot of getting to our fossil fuel reduction goals, and we shouldn't be relying on Wall Street because Wall Street, you know, may play that game to keep money coming into those companies, but in the long run, we're better when the public controls and the public has the accountability with elected officials over those public entities.
Well, we will definitely continue to follow this issue. Jamie Court is president of Consumer Watchdog, a nonprofit dedicated to providing a voice for citizens in an era when special interests dominate so many aspects of our lives. Jamie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Mike Wara is senior research scholar at the Stanford Woods Institute for the Environment, and he serves on California's Commission on Catastrophic Wildfire Cost and Recovery. Mike, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
And you can find more information about these very important issues at yourcallradio.org. And if you have any show ideas related to wildfires and just how the state should respond, utilities, we'd love to hear from you. Your call at kalw.org. Thanks to Laura Wenis for producing today's show and Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. And I hope you can join us for tomorrow's show. We will be talking about why so many horses are dying on U.S. horse tracks across the country. Thanks for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.